So last time we talked about presentations, the important slides. We have to write. We have to learn to write. There is really no other way. You are not going to be successful as scientists if you don't know, if you don't learn to write well. And you can write it. You can learn to write well. You can learn it. This is an important slide, remember. If you have an idea, a paper is just one idea. Occasionally, you may smuggle one more kind of small idea that is not worth a paper by itself. But it's one idea. What do you do when you have more ideas? You write more papers. Very simple. This story, remember, led to a very important slide, the conclusion. Never any suspense in a scientific paper. You say it outright from the very beginning. It should be clear from the very beginning to the end. No suspense. So this was an important slide. Interesting story. That's also important when you write. Here are just, small things. Try to predict, think about what the reader will get out of the paper, how you present your story. Let's see. Structure of a paper. I told you about this too. To mention that the important parts that are read by many, many people. You want people to learn how to spell your name correctly, especially if your name is Polish, I guess. Yeah, Trusdziel was definitely a challenge. Misspelled in many, many possible ways, but more and more people started to learn how to spell it. So we talked about different parts, conveying the idea, that's important. The details people will understand, the proofs, the theorems, the formulas, the ideas are important. Primary focus, not the secondary. What else? This is important, acknowledging generously the contribution of other people. If you don't give credits, that usually kills your paper. So you need to make sure that people see that you are aware of all the work that has been done before you. And there has been usually work done before you. It's very rare that you are opening a new area and nobody has worked in that area. Acknowledgements, be generous there. References, citations. A lot of rewrites, good idea, the paper will become better and better and better. You can even prove mathematically that it's going to be very good, right? It's every rewrite is making it better. Visual structure, pictures usually make things better. Don't use passive voice, I gave some examples. There were some Polish slides, because this is a problem still in Polish. In English, I think the battle about passive voice took place decades ago. I don't think people have a problem with that. Even if you write anything in Word, Word will underscore, change it into active voice. Plural, when there's a single author, looks funny. Tenses, abbreviations, good document. I wonder if it's still there because I know that Patterson has retired. I will mention him again in today's meeting in the context of presentations. I met him, wonderful scientist, very well-known scientist, but also great presenter. So this is his advice, small advice, details. Then many examples of phrases that can be simplified. I just, have a few that I go one by one, but then there are several pages that I took from that link. I haven't checked if it's still active, but I took the phrases. I found it quite funny, especially you know, the long phrases that can be just taken, left out without any loss of meaning of the paper. Okay, I think somewhere here we finished the process of writing. Start early, because papers written right before the deadlines, you usually see that in the paper. There are simple errors, simple problems. So start early, then you have the time to do revisions, to read it again carefully when you are rested, when you wake up during the best time of your day. You can read it, find problems with it. Reviewers, friendly reviewers, I mentioned that we had that slide. You can get people who are among your competition. That's always a little risky because they can get an idea from you. So you have to be somewhat careful. But when the paper is already published, is under review somewhere, or you publish it as a technical report in your department, it's safer. You can ask people for reviewing, for critiquing your paper. It's usually difficult to get people's attention, really. Sometimes people are afraid of revealing what they are doing, keeping the cards close to the medals, as they say. But in my experience, it's difficult to get people's attention to read your papers. Reviews. That thing is actually there also in presentations, so we'll talk about it also. Reviews and critique, questions in presentations are very valuable, so you should really treat them as like gold dust. Of course, it's very hard because when somebody criticizes us, you know, our first reaction, this first reaction of a man is, what's wrong with him? Why is he asking those questions? Is he stupid or something? But you should absolutely treat every critique like gold dust. It's very, very important. Even if they didn't understand your paper, at least you know the place that you have to spend more time to explain it well. So at least that. Even if they are completely off mark, misunderstood your paper, at least you know what to improve. You cannot, when you respond to reviewers, you often have a chance to respond. You send your paper to a journal, they send it back to you and say, for example, rejection with encouragement to resubmit. And then they send you the reviews, and what you can do is you can improve your paper and then respond to the reviewers. Don't ever think of writing, what a stupid reviewer, of course. Why don't you do that? Well, there is a comedy, an American comedy. It's quite stupid, actually. The title is Dumb and Dumber. It's about two really stupid guys, wild comedy. And there is a motif there. There are two mafia people following them. There's a man and a woman. And at some point, somewhere in the, you know, in the Midwest, they're driving to California. The woman gets kind of already impatient and says, let's do them. Let's do them both. To do somebody is to kill somebody, in the mafia language. And the guy, who is older, kind of more patient, says, you don't do people you don't know. It's a very important principle. In the mafia wars, of course, you don't kill somebody you don't know, because that somebody can have a whole family behind him, right? You don't insult somebody you don't know. I see that behavior actually sometimes. People don't know each other and they shout, you know, they quarrel. You don't do that. In science, absolutely, because you don't know who you are talking to. There's an anecdote, I don't know if it's true or not. There is an elderly couple who comes to the president of Harvard. It took them a while to get an appointment, but they made an appointment and see the president of Harvard and say, Mr. President, our son died, and we thought of... They are quite modestly dressed, you know, they don't look like big shots. They say, our son died, and we thought of donating some money in his name to the university, to Harvard. And the president looked at them and said, well, you know, I'm the president of Harvard. Why
why are you coming with, you know, this is a university that operates on a $20 million a year budget. That was early 20th century. That was a lot of money. Annual budget of $20 million. Why did you want to come to me to talk to me about this? And the couple realized that he is looking down upon them and he is kind of not treating them too well. And the woman looked at her husband and said, $20 million? It's all it takes to run a university? Let's go. They left and created Stanford in the name of their son, Leland Stanford. I don't know if it's a true story or not, but it's never a good idea to look down upon or insult people you don't know. Remember, it's an important principle in personal life, but also professional life. You don't know who they are, therefore, you cannot respond to them impolitely. Because you will have an enemy, you know, scientists also have the personal side, and they may put a, you know, a needle in your side when you don't know it. So don't ever do that. Always very polite, always very grateful. When they are saying something stupid, you can say something, thank you for this remark. I can see now how it could be misunderstood this way. And then explain it, right? Very, very polite. And also thank them warmly because they are contributing their time to reviewing your paper. It's very unusual that scientists are compensated financially for reviewing. I know it's in Poland, but that's very unusual. In the US, you never get any money for reviewing somebody's paper or dissertation or anything else. So usually it's the time that you commit out of your own will. So just thank them warmly because they've done something good to you, donated their time to you. Here are typically deadly faults: not reviewing prior work, not comparing with the competition, not explaining the scope, novelty, and importance of the work, carelessness, unfounded assumptions, arbitrary and unmotivated choices, too weak or too strong claims. So these are some of the checkpoints that you have to go through in checking. I haven't checked that. That's an old slide, at least 10 years. I met a young Polish woman who emigrated to United States with her parents as a teenager or even an elementary school child. And then she decided to return to Poland, to Białystok. And she's still here in Białystok. And she was doing, she was helping people with reviewing papers. That was a way of making money. She's an artist, actually. I don't know if she's doing that still. I have no financial interest. I just met her. Very interesting young lady. But what I want to say with this slide is get help. If you don't feel strong in English, there are people who will review your papers, correct the language for you. If you don't have friends who are good at English, there are also professional people. Sometimes you can even use some money from a grant to help with reviewing. I have no interest, as I said. Here are the conclusions. Essentially summarize what I said already, so I'm not going to go through them. Here are the important points. I guess that the final thing is there is really no one recipe for writing. You need to develop your own style. As I mentioned, some people do it top-down, some people do it bottom-up. I use myself a mixed strategy, and I have my reasons for that, but I don't think this is the best or the only way. So develop your own strategy of writing. And here we are. The next topic is presentations. Very related, because several ideas that are really the same in writing and presenting. Any questions? No. So here we are, presentations. If you remember, this was the simplest way of selling your work, right? Because it just takes you a little bit of time to prepare your presentation, make slides, and then present. It doesn't cost as much time as writing a paper. You should do it as often as you can.
of course, motivation, and then I will talk about the materials, and then skills, and then an important topic, elevator pitch, which belongs to presentations. Probably many of you know what it is, but if not, then I'll talk about it more. What's the big deal? It's the easiest, probably the least expensive way of advertising your work. So use it whenever you can, whenever you can. Even at this stage, look, there's going to be a department council that will approve your dissertation, approve the reviewers, the committee. You want people in your department to remember your name and to remember your name in good context. So whenever there's an opportunity to have a seminar in your department, use it, present, impress people, even in at the local level. Scientific meetings are incredibly good opportunities for networking. When you present well, people will remember you, they will like your work, they will want to talk to you, you meet them, create your network. The best teacher, of course, is practice. So you practice as often as you can. I talked about this. Whenever a friend sends you an email, I'm going to be in Białystok, what do you do? You email back saying, would you like to come to my department and tell something about your work? Whenever you go to Poznań and you know somebody at the university there, you send them an email saying, I'm going to be in Poznań. And what do they answer? Come and talk, tell something. And just use that opportunity. Say always yes. This is an important slide, really important, because I think some people misunderstand it. The most important thing in presentation, the most important rule is that you present to be understood. Sometimes people think that you present to I don't know what. You've seen presentations like this, where they put a lot of formulas, proofs, they lose the audience in the first few slides, everybody is falling asleep, and you know, it's a lost opportunity. A very important rule, you want to be understood. Some people think that if they are not understood, then everybody thinks, wow, how intelligent, how great they are. They are doing such complicated things that I don't even understand it. Very wrong way of thinking. If people understand you, they will see the greatness of your work, and also they will have an opportunity to give you feedback. Because if you lose them, if they don't understand you, they will be afraid of asking anything. So you really want people to understand what you're doing. So you have to be as clear as possible, as many people as possible in the audience follow you. Of course, it is rare that everybody will follow you. Some people will lose their thread. They will look out of the window and then they will come back and say, oh, well, I don't know where he is, right? That will happen. But you want to minimize the number of those people. Try to keep as many people as possible understanding you. You have to be very welcoming towards feedback. And that holds for presentations, but also for teaching. When you are teaching, you must have met teachers like that. You ask a question and they say, what do you mean? I talked about it last week. That's a terrible way of handling a question from students, from the audience. Because how do you feel when you get this answer? Well, the hell freezes before I ask another question to this guy, right? That's the typical reaction. So by acting like this, you essentially break the communication between the audience, the classroom, and you. So every question you should really treat with respect. Be thankful for the people's time. Be thankful for them, for people to be here even in your presentation. You have to be friendly and welcoming. It's one of the biggest mistakes that people make, that not respecting, not treating the audience well, not treating the questions well. We'll come back to that. This is also somewhat important. Before you give a talk, before you even prepare your slides, try to find out who the people are that you are going to present to. Sometimes it's a simple question. You can ask, suppose you work with whatever, deep neural networks. You can ask your colleague who invited you to talk how many people in the audience will have worked with deep neural networks, how many people know what they are. I have to say that I usually ask those questions whenever I get invited to talk somewhere, because I need to know the audience a little bit. That tells me whether I should start with very elementary things so I can go immediately into the more advanced stuff. Another thing is, okay, so you prepare the presentation for this audience. Of course, you don't have the time to prepare 15 versions of your presentation, but you can make some small changes, and you can also adjust the way you talk. The slides may be similar, but you talk differently. Another thing is keeping contact with the audience. People feel better when you look at them, when you have contact. If you sometimes people, I've seen people sometimes present like this. I bet this is not my best sight, the best sight of my body. They do that because they want to read the slides, maybe, or I don't know why. Maybe they are shy. So face the audience. Keep the eye contact with them. Then you, the same, of course, when teaching. When you teach and it's too complex, you see people yawning or you see people lost, looking at their cell phones or something. You know that you are going too fast or you are not interesting enough. So look at the audience. And the structure of your talk is very similar to a paper, really. It has to have a clear structure and logical flow. So think about it when preparing the presentation. You start almost always with introducing the problem. What is the problem that you are going to address in this presentation? Motivate it. Why is it important? What are the applications of this problem? Where does it appear? So that people understand that this is an important problem. It's not just something invented on the fly, not needed to anybody. Show your way of addressing the problem. Of course, before that, you should say what other people have done, how they address this problem, and then how you address this problem. And it's important, they call it a take-home message. A take-home message is when people listen to your talk, they get the most important idea, and when they exit the room, they think about this idea. Oh, that was really cool what that person did. So it's good to think about it yourself as a presenter. What do you want to put in people's head? Please note how effective people are, for example, in politics. You know, they are really masters. In advertising, they know much more than we do how to manipulate people. When you present, you don't really manipulate. You should be honest and tell about your work. But there is a little bit of salesmanship here, right? We want people to remember how to spell our name. That's the vanity of a scientist, and we want the people to remember that you solved the problem, or you are working on a problem. It's an important problem, and you solved it, because they will remember you. They will cite you. So, the take-home message is something that you kind of think about in advance. What do you want people to get out of your talk? Slides. Not too much text. If you have some time, I'll show you a couple of examples where there is one word per slide. That's incredible. I was at the talk live. It was amazing. The guy had just one word on a slide very often, on one picture. It was so good, you couldn't stop following the talk. Amazing. You can do that too. But typically you have some words, some things, not too much text. The font should be sufficiently large. The font that you see here on the bottom, I mean the text, it's probably 18 or 20 point. I try not to go down from there. Of course, in things like that, it's just a reminder where we are, or This is the title of the presentation. They can be a little smaller because they are not that important, and people usually decipher them in the beginning. But the text should be sufficiently large. Keep in mind that many people who listen to you will be older. At my age, I need glasses for reading, and my eyes are getting worse. So if I sat in the back of the room, I would have a hard time reading the smaller fonts. Guidance to the audience, that's this thing here. That was an idea that I got from a psychologist, one of the people that you saw in the very, very beginning, Baruch Fishkov. He said something like, he came to my trial talk, and he said, well, you know, I saw somebody do that, and I liked it so much, some guidance. So I started doing that. That was almost 30 years ago. I think it was a good idea. And it is something that's on every slide. If you go back and forth, you see it's not changing. It turns out that eyes, human eyes, are not sensitive to things that don't change. We see things that change. So it's not disturbing having that. You see, it's not really disturbing me. It's not changing. And people who get lost because they looked out of the window, they got a text message or something, they can always pick up and see where you are. That's usually a good thing. And there are many ways of doing this. I've seen it like a bar on the top or on the bottom with some names, and it's getting darker as they progress with the talk. So there are many ways of doing this. I have chosen this one. Pictures and graphs whenever appropriate, of course. Usually less is more, so don't overload your audience with too much information. Just important things. You can say things. With the technology, we can do a lot of things, audio, video, demos, etc. I remember when PowerPoint first started being used, I think it was 1990s, people were so enthusiastic about it. They used animation, they used sounds, etc., all kinds of things. When you look at my slides, I do use animations, but not too often. I must say that I took a step back from that. When I was first taught how to present, it was with plastic slides. The guy who was teaching us had a piece of paper, a sheet of paper, and he was opening the bullet points one by one. Apparently, he thought it was a good idea. I had it, but I stopped doing this. I think that all of you know what to focus on. You want to see everything. And then as I talk, you see where I am. So I think it's better than just doing it one by one appearing. But again, it's a personal choice maybe. Movie clips are fine. They are nice diversification. Software demos are also very nice. But of course, you have to be careful. If your software is not very reliable, developed in your doctorate, you don't want it to fail in the middle of the presentation. And they tend to fail precisely when you are presenting it. So it's a risky thing, but if you want to take the risk, it's really nice. Some people record the demos and then just show a movie. Jokes are great, but only if you are humorous by nature. If you are not humorous, then you know, you don't know how to tell jokes, they would say, then they will not sound too good. So do things that are natural to you. Be natural. There's a saying in Dutch, it's a very repressive culture, I think. There's a saying, behave normally, because you are crazy enough when you behave normally. You know, don't do crazy, because you are crazy enough when you are behaving normally. It's not natural to... It looks funny when you are doing things that are not natural to you. Very important rule. So do things that you find natural, that you are comfortable with. Avoid risky jokes and risky statements. You know, when you see somebody bald, don't make jokes about balding people. I don't mind it, but I'm just giving you an example. Because, you know, you never know whom you can hurt. Some statements, some jokes are risky.
avoid them. And it's not because I'm politically correct. I hate political correctness. But you don't want to alienate anybody. You want to keep as many people as possible following you, right? So that's the reason. Of course, you know, if you present any graphs, you have to explain them, because this is a joke. It's completely useless, this graph. So don't do things like that. Animation, I would say, use it whenever they serve a purpose, and only when they serve a purpose. Sound effects, don't use at all. I remember there was a very good scientist visiting Carnegie Mellon when I was still a student there, and she would have, every time that a line, a bullet point, went from left to right, there was a sound like zzzz. And every time there was a zzzz, the whole audience was laughing. Essentially, scientists are not very tolerant to this kind of thing. So don't do that. It's not a good idea. And not too many colors. They found that 5 colors, I think, is the maximum. So not too many, just a handful. There were studies in psychology. 5 is max. If you look at my slides, I use, I don't know, 3 colors or so. No, not too many. Here is a negative example. That sound effect. You can do it in PowerPoint, but the fact that you can do something should not mean that you should do it, right? This is, of course, it is a bad example of a graph, by the way, from a textbook that gives many examples of bad graphs, but also this whole idea of, you know, the animation that fulfills no purpose. The sound effect completely useless. What is bad about, well, this graph is that it shows the salaries, relative salaries equalized via the PFP Big Mac index, whatever. These are the salaries of, I think, rock stars. But we don't know whether it's the height of the person or the size, the area. That's bad about this graph. There are many ways of lying or misleading the audience. It's a bad graph. But I wanted to show you the many colors, unnecessary things. It's a bad example. Don't do things like that. How much time should you plan for? Before you, at the time that you agree to talk, you should absolutely ask how much time you have. It's important. You cannot just come to a place without knowing how long can you talk. You can talk for. Conferences are usually easy. There is a program of the conference. There are sessions. A session will take 1.5 hours, for example. Every presentation will be 20 minutes, maybe 20 plus 5 minutes questions. Don't talk more than the allotted time. Absolutely. Practice at home so that you can say everything that you want to say within that time. I've seen presentations, sometimes people would present and then the time passes, the chairman of the session or the chairwoman of the session gets up, starts approaching because she was waving and the speaker didn't see that, so she gets here to kick out the speaker from the lecture. And the speaker says, oh, well, I will skip those slides, and then skips 10 or 15 slides. And that's a ridiculous idea. You should practice so that you prepare and present everything that you wanted to present, not that you were gracefully allowed to as a surprise. So always ask how long the time is, and then prepare for that time. Many people ask how many slides you should plan for. There is a heuristic that I heard very early on, roughly 1 slide a minute. So if you have 20 minutes in a conference, 20 slides max. And that's just a heuristic, just a rule of thumb. Because I've seen counter examples. When I show you, if we have time,
a bit of presentation of Lorenz Lessig, where he has one word per slide, I bet he has five slides per minute. I've once had a PhD defense. I was remotely participating in the defense as a committee member, and the student sent me her slides. And typically a defense has 40 minutes talk or so, and there was 137 slides, I think. Anyway, more than 130 for sure. So I gently asked her, do you think, is it not too many slides? And she said, no problem, I practice. Some of the slides are back up and I will do fine. And you know what? She did fine. I was surprised, I didn't believe her. But she finished within 40 minutes. And of course, there were 10 or 20 slides that were back up, but she did it. So there are exceptions, but if you have no experience, if you are just starting, it's a good rule. Start with that, and usually it's fine, 1 minute per slide. Then you don't need to hurry, you just explain the idea well on one slide per minute. How do you start? I had this problem. Remember, I had a practice talk, maybe when I was looking for a job, just after getting my PhD. Or maybe it was a practice talk before my qualifying exam. I forgot what it was. But there were a few people in the audience. And there was, I think it was again Baruch Fischhoff, that psychologist. And he noticed that in the very beginning, I didn't know how to start. It took me like, 15 or 20 seconds before I said the first sentence. So he told me, you have to prepare that. Before you even do the presentation, have a sentence that you will start with when you are not that experienced yet. So there are many openings. Like you can say, today I'm going to talk about da-da-da. Thank you for this generous introduction. When you have an invited talk, people announce you, say who you are, where you got your PhD, etc. You can say something like, thank you for this generous introduction. That's a very modest statement, right? I don't deserve it, but it was very generous. Or if you are coming back to Białystok University of Technology after 10 years, they invited you to talk here, you can say something like, it's a pleasure to be here after all these 10 years, right? Anyway, beginning. Here I remember an anecdote that, you know who this is? You may know it, Robert, no?
No.
This is Dr. Ruth Westheimer, a psychologist. I think she may be American or living in US. I don't know if she's still alive, because that's a picture that I think from 1990s or so. A psychologist of Israeli descent, her voice, such a heavy Hebrew accent, she was speaking like a crow, really, the very thing. And she was teaching Americans how to do sex. That was her full-time job. She would go from one place to another, giving presentations. She would have a column in the periodicals where people would ask questions, she would answer. And once she came to Carnegie Mellon, I was a student. I didn't have that much time, so I didn't go to that talk. But then I read an article in the university newspaper, and the journalist was very funny. He wrote something like this: the room was packed. There were like 500 people in the lecture room, and she was answering questions. And then at some point, somebody raised a hand in the back row, and she said, "Yes." A young man stood up. And then there was silence, and you could see his face getting red and green and blue, and clearly he couldn't say a word. And Dr. Westheimer said, "Why don't you start? My friend has the following problem." That was funny, really funny. In any case, think about the starting, how you start, because it's, when you are there and you are not experienced yet, you may have stage fright, you may not know what to say. That happened to me. It took me 10 seconds or 15 seconds before I said the first sentence, so prepare something. No stop words. Mm-hmm, pravda, yes. People say all kinds of things.
Here I have an anecdote. There is an organization called, it's an international organization called Toastmasters International. I don't know if anybody has seen the name. Toastmasters, it's, you know, from toasts. To the health of everybody here, right? A toast. And this is an organization that teaches people how to do public speaking. It's an international organization. There was also a branch in Białystok. I have one of the slides in the back, poster from when I saw it. I don't know if they are still active or not. It's just a matter of people if they want to do it. Anyway, they meet usually once a week for an hour or so. And during the meetings, they practice presentations. There's always somebody who is giving a short presentation, 5 or 10 minutes. During the presentations, they designate somebody to be criticizing that person, to be saying good things, bad things. And there's always a person who has to count the all kinds of stop words. And I remember, I was very curious, when I was at IBM, these were my first months in US, I did all kinds of crazy things. I took part, there was an announcement, we are meeting for the shooting club meeting. Shooting, that's what Mareks love best, right? So I sent email back, I would like to come, but I don't have any guns. Oh, don't worry, we have plenty of guns. Okay. So I come there, and you know, actually I may have it in my office. I got a reward. I was the best in B category in trap shooting, you know, the thing that... Anyway, there was an announcement, Toastmasters International. Of course, that's what Mareks loves best. I went to the meetings. And I attended those meetings because I found them useful. One day it was my turn. I gave a presentation of 10 minutes. I was so proud of myself. I practiced, you know, I had wonderful slides. I had a joke there, everything. And then there was some critique, and then the person who was supposed to count the it was her turn, and she said, 37 in 10 minutes. Wow, that was shocking to me. I don't know how many I do now, but, you know, for 30 years, I've been trying to reduce that. Record yourself. You will see that each one of us does it. So it's a good idea to be aware of that and not to do it. Don't read the text. Say things in your own words. Because when you read, it looks funny. It doesn't look natural. You're showing lack of confidence in yourself. And that kind of radiates. People think, well, you know, maybe he's not knowing his stuff so well, right? So say with your own words. You can glance at your slides to see what you are going to say, but you should roughly know what you are going to say and just say it. Say it with your own words without using very wise, complicated, difficult words. Just say it as if you were explaining it to your colleague. Physical behavior. Well, all kinds of things. You probably have seen that. Some people, well, you look at the audience, of course, you should do that. Be natural, I said that already. If you feel nervous, there is a trick. I learned it from somebody. Somebody was telling that. Even if the audience is very difficult, like, you know, you lost half of the people, others are checking their phones, etc., find in the audience somebody who is listening to you. And there's usually somebody who is listening to you. And look at that person all the time, you know, when you're explaining. And that kind of gives you some confidence, because you're explaining to that person is looking attentively, listening to you. It's a trick, small trick that helps you when you present. Some people step from one leg to another, some people have all kinds of things. I remember when I was studying in Poland, before I left, that was... late 1970s, I studied at Warsaw University of Technology. There was a teacher who was teaching abstract algebra, very difficult topic. I found it very difficult. He was a grandmaster bridge player. Bridge is one of those card games. It's one of those novel games where there was actually a column in the local newspaper, Życie Warszawy,
And the title was Zapytajmy Arcymistrza, Let's Ask the Grandmaster. And here the column where he would explain things. So we knew he was a master and bridge player. When he was giving those lectures, with right hand he was writing, he was doing a lot of this, he was doing, you know, all kinds of movements. And we were talking after the lectures that he was showing to his partner what cards he had in his hand, you know. Showing by you know, in bridge you cannot reveal your cards. There are ways of telling, but so, well, don't do that. As few as possible, those nervous movements. It's okay to move, I think. I'm moving. I don't know how it looks like. Last I watched myself record it, it's okay. It provides some diversity. I guess you know, you look around. It doesn't look like I'm sleeping. And that's, I think, the good thing about it. So moving is fine, but no nervous movements. There's a very good joke that I will tell you maybe at the end, before we part. It's a Jewish joke about Dr. Dropkin. Jewish humor is so similar to Polish humor, believe me. It's very, well, I found it very good, because I guess I'm used to Polish humor. You can see it actually live. There was a website, Old Jews Telling Jokes. It was told very nicely. I'll try to tell it to you. You can watch it if the links are still active. Recording yourself. I have to warn you that this is a masochistic experience. You will hate yourself when you watch yourself. And if you feel that, when I listen to my recording, I feel, oh boy, the voice of that guy, I would immediately dislike him the first time I meet that person. The same with the recording, you suddenly see all kinds of funny movements, things that you are doing wrong, you see errors in your language, pronunciation, all kinds of things. So it's a difficult experience, but absolutely recommend it. And this is so easy now. You just use your cell phone, start recording, give a presentation, and watch it. It's a very good experience, even though it's so difficult, so masochistic, terrible to us. Questions. That is a killer of presentations. So I told you in the beginning that you have to treat your audience with respect. And the same is with presentations and with teaching. When a student asks you something, I've seen great speakers handle questions. A student, a colleague of mine, you know, big Ola, and he would ask a question, a stupid question, something that the teacher spent half an hour on in the previous meeting. And the teacher would do something like, oh, I see. And then he would give the answer. 1, 2, 3 sentences. Never would the teacher say, that was a stupid question, I talked about this, right? The idea here is that you want to keep the communication going between the students and the teacher. So when you teach, and many of you will be teaching, remember that. Don't lose the communication, don't alienate your students. The same with audiences when you give a talk. Be grateful to them, be thankful for them, and start inside, you know, you really should be thankful in your heart, not just playing thankful. There have been experiments with salespeople. I was told about it, I didn't read it. Somebody told me that the experiments were as follows. There were two groups, of course, control and treatment salespeople, and they told the salespeople in the treatment group to have like a meditation before the actual sales session, to explain to themselves, to kind of make sure that they believe that they love the clients. I love my clients, I love them. You know that these salespeople sold more? It's amazing. So you should really, if you don't generally love people, I love people, I discovered it over my life, that I just like people, I love people. So if you don't have those good feelings towards people, try to work on that. And before presentations, just, you know, explain to yourself. I'm really grateful, thankful to the audience, and treat them this way. So when they ask you a question, of course, make them feel good. Think about it. What makes them feel good? You are giving a presentation in a department. They are all colleagues. I would say, of course, they are very serious. They are giving you advice and they are asking questions, etc. But one way of making them feel good is playing on their vanity also. Because people who are in the university, scientists, they want to be, they really appreciate it when people think they are smart. Don't you think so? Wouldn't you like to be thought of as smart, intelligent? So when they ask a question, you should actually, in front of their colleagues, you should somehow hint that that was a good question, that that they actually understood it very well, to the core of the thing. So when you answer, you know, there is a rule, you never criticize people in front of others. You know that, those rules, right? You don't say, even to children, when you criticize your child, don't do it in front of the other children, the brothers and sisters. Go to a separate room saying, you know, I love you, you are one of my four most favorite sons, as I say to my sons. I have four sons, as I usually say, you are one of my four most favorite sons, but this is what I didn't like in your behavior. You know, you do it separately. But praising is different. You can praise in front of the others, and it's okay. So when you answer the question, there are many ways of appreciating it. You can say, that's an interesting question. When it's a stupid question, you can say, well, that is an interesting question. I haven't thought about it this way, right? Maybe the colleagues think it's a stupid question, but you don't show it. You don't say it like this. When they ask a good question, express it, say it, saying like, well, thank you for asking this question. It's almost as if I, you know, as you and I talked before, I paid you to ask this question. Or it's a central question to what I was talking about. You got to the core of this problem. You know, there are many ways of saying things that make the person feel good. If you are rude and unwelcoming, then you are discouraging others. So remember, one of the two goals is to get feedback. When people don't ask you questions, you don't get feedback. So you wasted some time. You want people to ask you questions. Being rude and unwelcoming, sometimes people can do it with their face, you know, with the way they look at the audience. That often kills the talk. There was a guy in my department, the one where I got my PhD. He spent years as a postdoc, and every year he was looking for a faculty position. And every year he would get invited here and there, but he would not get a job. So then the department chair, he told us that in the same context, telling us about the importance of answering questions. Apparently, through the grapevine, through the network, through the friends, he learned that he was screwing up on answering questions. When people ask questions in his job talk, the way he answered, it made people not very welcome. And they didn't think he would be a good teacher. So they didn't hire him. He got a faculty position eventually, but that was a problem he had at that time. So pay attention to that. If you want to be understood, liked, appreciated, it's an important point, handling questions. Toastmasters International. I didn't check this year if there is a club in Białystok. Last year there was none, I think, but you can find it. You can create it even. You get materials from them that help you with organizing. You can start meeting. I think it's a good idea. The next topic I wanted to talk about is the elevator pitch. Elevator pitch, the name comes from startups. When you have an idea, you create a company, there are many people who want to invest in good ideas. And they are called venture capitalists. They have money, sometimes other people's money, and they invest in companies to get tenfold back, right? And the idea is good. So in order to get money from them, investment, you need to convince them that your idea is good. And then typically they don't have a lot of time. They see many people, they see a lot of ideas. So they want you want to be able to present your idea in a very short time, in as much time as it takes to go from the ground floor to the fifth floor in the building, in an elevator. That's how much time you have. Okay? And you should always be ready to, when somebody asks you in a coffee line, in a conference, what are you working on? You should actually have 3, 4, 5 sentences telling about what you are doing. Very short, at most a minute. And when talking to the, when telling that, you should look at their, at the people that you are telling it to. If you see interest, they ask you questions, you can turn it into half an hour conversation if they want to. But if you see no interest, stop. Some people, you know, you ask them and then they keep telling you, and you say, you know what, I have to go. Difficult to leave them. So be kind of attentive, but you have this 30 seconds or a minute to say something about your work. Say it in an interesting way, kind of have them ask for more. But if they don't ask, don't keep going. So the questions that you will get is what you are working on, what research problem are you working on. You get these questions in a conference, queuing up for coffee, during lunch. You should ask those questions too, because these are the best ways of building your network, talking to people. That's where it comes from, and it is used everywhere. People in Polish, it's zagadanie w windzie. That's the Polish term of that. But I'm sure it's used also in business. I had a funny anecdote. Once I visited a colleague of mine in Singapore, and she had many students in her lab who were from China. There were like, I don't know, 8 people or 10 people in the lab, and she kind of invited me to. Maybe it was a brown bag lunch where we had lunch and talked. And she asked if they would tell me what they are doing. It was funny because each one of them had this elevator pitch, but it looked like they learned it by heart. they were looking almost in the ceiling when they were speaking it. It was really funny. It wasn't natural. So make it natural. Just be prepared to say a few sentences about your work. A few sentences, not more. So that's more about it. I think I took it from Wikipedia, the texts. It is used in many places. Salespeople, evangelists, you know. Have you thought about what happens with you when you die? Right? And there are people who will ask you those questions. If you watch the Forrest Gump, there is a guy, a military guy, who says, have you given a thought what you are going to do with your career, right? Join the Marines, whatever formation he was going. The same thing, my idea. You should have a hook, which is like fishing hook, something that makes people want more, and get their attention, and you will quickly figure it out. People who are very busy, like the venture capitalists, and I've spoken to venture capitalists too. They've listened to many people. It's not that easy to get their attention. And you can see in their face that they are looking at their watch or the phone or around and stop. But try to get their attention. Energy and passion, that sells. People who are energetic and passionate, they sell better. The same with your elevator pitch, energy and passion. I remember one of my advisors, you've seen him, his face in the beginning. I liked him so much from the very beginning because he would be so passionate. He died a few years ago, Professor van der Hoorn. It was in the Netherlands. He would come into the lecture room, just, you know, regular classes like that, and within 10 seconds, he would start talking in such an enthusiastic and passionate way about things that now I may find boring, but I found it so interesting at that time. I wanted to work with that guy. I wanted to write my master's thesis with him. And I did, right? Just because of the enthusiasm that he had, passion. When you are in the audience, that's the other side of talking. Of course, you are contributing your time to the speaker, and you also benefit from the presentation. You learn about some ideas. So you should come to all kinds of research seminars. There are seminars in your department for sure. Try to be there. You can help the speaker by listening. If it's your colleague, then you know obviously you should help your colleague by listening, looking at him or her. Try to follow, ask questions. Ask questions to show your colleagues to the other faculty how smart you are. By asking good questions, you can rarely go wrong, really. So it's a good way of making your name, your face familiar. Criticism. I've seen that there is a lot of difference between criticism that I've seen at conferences in US and I've seen in Poland. Maybe there were different conferences, I don't know. But the difference was that in Poland I've seen a lot of aggression from the audience. And then the aggression was directed towards people who were younger, less experienced. I was at a conference once, I forgot where it was in Poland. My wife, not yet my wife, but I knew her quite well. A short woman, you know, still young and beginning working on her dissertation before her doctorate. And me, a big professor, you know, when I had a talk, a few questions, very friendly. My wife presented, and then questions, and critical questions. And, you know, everybody felt urged to say something critical in the audience. Luckily, she felt quite confident because she knew the work was good. She just had got review from a major conference that was quite friendly, with some good advice, but actually praising her work. So she knew she didn't have to feel like a small, you know, somebody who did something wrong. But people felt urged to criticize. It was empirical work. It was an experiment. Experiments are always easy to criticize. So, you know, everybody, you know, the dog in the last row also felt urged to say something critical. That happens. And I've seen really sometimes critical, quite critical things, especially towards the little guys. So like you are now, right? In US, I've seen a much more kind of fundamental respect, which is, I think, much wiser. Because keep in mind that the little guy will be a big guy in a few years from now and may get even with those who were aggressive. Not very smart to do it. There are many polite expressions that you can say. Suppose that you think it's wrong, right? You say, well, it's very interesting, but it seems to me that, you know, on slide 7, it should be the other way. I can say that. It's a very polite way of pointing out that there is an error, maybe. Suppose the results are different than in other papers, and you think they are wrong. You can say, could it be possible that the results that you have shown, that we have seen, are due to, and then you say some, you know, something that could have happened in the experiment. Or you say, instead of saying, well, this is bullshit because most of the papers are showing the other way, you can say, your results seem to be quite different than those of Smith and Jones and whatever, Brown. Do you have any insight why are they different? That's a very polite way of asking. And besides, the speaker can be right. You don't know. So, what do you do when the work is completely beyond repair? Like, you know, you listen to it and say, wow, boy, this person does not know what he or she is speaking about. What do you do then? Well, you can always get up and say, you are doing... But typically people just don't ask any questions.
That's what typically happens. So when you see silence, when there's a speech, somebody presents something, and there are no questions at all, that's actually a bad sign. Very bad sign. Could be that this was really very good, people don't know what to say, but typically it's because there is really, if you, you know, start criticizing, it's like a can of worms, right? It's so that's a very strange situation for the speaker also, when there are no questions. I'll come back to that in a moment.
Sometimes you have the task of introducing a speaker. You will have that task very soon. Your friend coming from Poznań to Białystok, you invited her to talk. Of course, they will tell you, would you please introduce the speaker? Well, you come there. As a minimum, you say the name, the affiliation. Miss Brzozowska is working at the Poznań Institute of University of Technology. Or she got her doctorate in this department. So these are the minimum things. If there are nice things to say, you can say other things. Like she worked in this field and that. She became quite well known for her work in. You can say things like that, nice things. Very polite, thankful for the speaker to be here, say something nice, but don't overdo it. Sometimes I've seen here, and I feel terrible. I once went to, I gave a talk somewhere at the University of Białystok, and the person said something about me using the Polish expression wybitny naukowiec. Boy, I mean, I felt so bad there. I don't think I'm... wybitny means in Polish extraordinary, something like that, you know. That's overdoing. You don't do that, because that sounds, you know, at the border of making fun of somebody. You don't know for sure. Maybe they think that way, but I don't think you should do that ever. Just say good things about the person, what the person has done, but don't overdo it. When you announce, be smiling, perhaps joking, but confident. I've seen several very nice introductions, kind of joking. But the best I've ever seen was introducing Herb Simon. He was one of the people I consider mentors. It was his 80th birthday. There was a symposium devoted to him, and he had an invited main plenary talk. Clark Glimmer, my colleague from, you probably also saw him too, a philosopher, he had the task of introducing, and he said something like, "Ladies and gentlemen, I always, all my life, I dreamt about introducing a speaker who does not need any introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, Herb Simon." That was really funny. Everybody knew him indeed, so it was funny. So you can be creative, you can do that, but just don't overdo it, because remember that that overdoing is very close to making fun. And that's a risky thing. When you are conference session chair, you will be asked to do that very quickly. Maybe after you go to a conference 2-3 times, your name will be recognizable, and they will ask you, would you please chair that session? Session is usually like 1.5 hours long. There are a few speakers, 3-4 speakers. Each one gets 20 minutes, 5 minutes for questions. And your task is to introduce the speakers, to keep an eye on the time, because you need to finish on time so that people can have coffee during the break. And what I do did sometimes, I don't have the time for that anymore, but I used to ask people before the conference, like a few days, a few weeks before the conference, would you please send me a copy of your paper? So that I knew what the paper is about. That was kind of good, but I don't have the time for it anymore, so I don't do it, but it's a good idea, I think. And another thing very important, remember, no questions, very, very bad for the speaker, right? You don't want the speaker to pull out a sword and start cutting the belly, right? If there are no questions, as a chair of the session, you should say, in that case, I have a question. And then you say, you ask a question. So during the talk of that person, think about the question. Think about one or two questions that you will ask. do that, absolutely. Yeah. Just to save the face of the speaker. Oops, I pressed something. I used to do, and that's a good idea also, you can show the how many minutes are left. And these days you can do it with PowerPoint, you can display digits, you know, the number of minutes. It's a good idea. I've done it too. In the past, there was like, you show up a sheet of paper with three, means you have 3 minutes left, right? If they don't listen to you, you show zero. If they don't finish, you sit somewhere here, you get up. If they still don't finish, you start walking to them. If they still ignore you, you go here. It helps to be a bigger guy. Essentially push them out, because they have to finish. There are other people that are talking, there's coffee waiting also. So that's your task. And you know, you kind of, as it escalates, you use appropriate force, but you do it. And if there is a discussion, sometimes there is a discussion, people disagree in the audience, you can break those discussions, saying, a good way of doing it is saying, I propose to take this offline, and maybe you can talk about it during the break. That's a good way. You are in power, remember, so they have to listen to you. So, and you have to do it. Keep your presentation simple as possible. Another thing is the best spontaneity. So when you, sometimes you see a speaker holding his hand in the pocket, just, you know, almost like the things are falling out of the sleeve, so easy. That person was born a speaker. That's usually not true. That's a spontaneity, but it's the best spontaneity is a well-prepared one, well-prepared spontaneity. So if you want to look like that, just practice a few times before the speech. Practice. Definitely a good idea. And with time, when it's your 30th, 50th presentation, it's going to be easy, really easy, because it's not a big deal. In the beginning, you have to do a lot of things consciously. You have to do it. It starts all inside. If you watch those children movies like Karate Kid or so, you remember. The kid was asked to clean the car of the guy, and then got upset, no, I'm not going to do it anymore for you. And then the guy showed him, by trying to punch him, that the movements that he was using to clean the car, he could use for blocking the foundations. I was once, again, my curiosity, I was doing kendo for 2 or 3 years, Japanese sword fighting, with this you know, wooden thing, boken. Can be deadly too, by the way. And one day, there was a Japanese grandmaster who came for training, and we thought, you know, somewhere here, he will show us those cuts that we can cut the opponent, you know, those wonderful tricks. You know, the first hour of the training, he asked us to walk around the room. And walking in kendo is kind of funny, because you walk all like that. You don't move up and down, just because you want to hide your intentions. That was, by the way, difficult when I started to dance. Because in dancing, you have to show your intentions to your partner. It all starts inside. And like I said, you should tell yourself that you love people, love your audience. That helps if you don't love people naturally. Don't hesitate to be different. If I'll have maybe a few minutes to show you some unconventional things. Some things are risky, but they may work. PowerPoint is not necessarily the best tool. Pen and paper, we don't have the equipment for that. But in the past, we had those overhead slide projectors. You could actually take a piece of plastic and write on it. In fact, David Patterson, I think I have his name on the next slide, he did something unconventional. I'll say it in a moment. You have to connect with the audience. Definitely, there should be some connection. And you don't want to be boring, especially if people are waiting for coffee or lunch. I heard once an anecdote. There was a whole day presentations of refrigerator manufacturers trying to, you know, to sell their refrigerators to the I think maybe to department stores or people who buy that. 4 o'clock, last session, the guy said essentially, he came to the presentation, showed the name of the manufacturer that he was representing, and he said, you know what? Our refrigerators are just as good or maybe better than all the others that you've seen today. Let's go for dinner now. And in that anecdote that I read, he got the most contracts. You can do things like that too, very unconventional. But you know, if you are boring, you are not necessarily winning. I think this is the last slide. A few exceptions. David Patterson, I was at a conference with my advisor, Van der Hoor. We went to Pisa. We drove from the Netherlands to Pisa, to Italy. And everybody was so excited about being able to print slides on plastic. That was, those were the times. You printed them, and they used, I think, LaTeX to generate the slides. The tool wasn't that good. The pictures were not wonderful in there. But they were kind of stiff, those slides. David Patterson invited the speaker, plenary speaker in the conference. He came with slides that he prepared on the plane. Just, you know, plastic sheets with pens, colored pens. And then he used pens during the presentation. He would underscore, he would put an exclamation mark, question mark when talking. Very, you could say, messy compared to those beautiful printed versions. This was the best talk in the conference. I like it most. Different software Macintosh has, I've seen it at a conference in Krakow, a guy was using that. Another colleague of mine was using MindMap, another piece of software where you kind of have a tree structure. He was moving into different regions of the screen. It's almost like a huge, huge screen, and he was moving on the slide that. Lessig, I will show you a moment. Rosling, watch this presentation. It's excellent. Absolutely one of the best presentations I've seen. He shows numbers, graphs, but it's so good that it's very inspiring. Just 10 minutes or 15 minutes. You have the time to do that. Lessig, I'll show you, and I will tell you the joke at the end. I think we will finish on time. So Lessig, actually we have... Maybe this will be best to watch on YouTube. Actually, no. I think the whole link is YouTube. No, that. Sorry. I'm going just to show you a minute of that. Oh, it's not there. Here we are. You know Ted, I hope. Ted has a lot of good talks, good speakers, good talks, so you can watch them for inspiration. Why am I not hearing anything? I thought there were stickers in here. These are his slides, by the way. While I'm looking for the to turn on the. I don't see where to turn on the speaker. Maybe I haven't downloaded. Let's go in the middle.
That he spoke so passionately to Congress about user-generated content, spreading in businesses in extraordinarily valuable ways like these, celebrating amateur culture, by which I don't mean amateurish culture. I mean culture where people produce for the love of what they're doing and not for the money. I mean the culture that your kids are producing all the time. For when you think of what Sousa romanticized in the young people together singing the songs of the day of the old songs, you should recognize what your kids are doing right now. Taking the songs of the day and the old songs and remixing them to make them something different. It's how they understand access to this culture. So let's have some very few examples to get a sense of what I'm talking about here. There's something called anime music videos, first example, taking anime captured from television, re-edited to music tracks.
You get an idea of the slides. Very unusual, very unconventional, and also very good. Let's see if there's anything else I wanted to show you. I have Hitler practicing his speech. By the way, he was an excellent speaker. You know, the things he was speaking, there's very few good things about that, but I think you can find him. You see the contact with the audience, the expressiveness, the things like that. Let's see if we can find it. Just a moment. Since we have a minute. With subtitles. This looks like a good speech. Look at him. They say that he practiced in front of a mirror, so he was really practicing a lot before his speeches. The contact he has with the audience, right? That's enough. I want to finish on time, I think I have just a couple of minutes for the joke. I have 4 minutes. It's a long joke. But believe me, it's worth waiting until the end. So the joke is about a scientist, Dr. Dropkin. Doctor, of course, is an honorary title, the highest in US that you can get. So if you call somebody a doctor, it's actually, you know. In Poland, I've seen people calling each other doctor, like, you know, a doctor, you go get some coffee or something, you know. Doctor is the lowest grade, but... not in U.S. So Dropkin grew up in a small town, smaller than Białystok, just, you know, a really small town. And he went to elementary, high school there. He went to college, the bigger town, and then he did his doctorate in Boston at MIT, and he became very famous, many publications. People knew him all over the world. And at some point, the mayor of the town decided to ask him to come and give an invited talk in his hometown, a small town. He accepted gladly the invitation, and when he came, you know, they took the biggest room that was available. All the local radio stations, all the TV stations had a live transmission of that event. There were flowers, there was a carpet that he could walk through, you know, everything. And he came to the lecture. It was old times. There was no computers, no PowerPoint, no overhead slides. He had just a collection of papers that he would read in front of a lecture and with a microphone. And what happened is some of the pages of his speech fell down on the floor. So he bent to pick them up, and then the muscles of his anus loosened up a little, and he passed gas. But he passed gas in front of the microphones there that transmitted it all live across the city. There were even loudspeakers in the streets. So suddenly there was like a thunder in the whole thing. Of course, people were very nice. That's United States, you know. They were not criticizing him. They behaved calmly. And Dr. Dropkin was a worldly man, so he didn't, he collected his compassion very quickly, stood there, delivered the speech. There were questions that he answered. There was clapping at the end. No sooner the clapping ended, he thanked the audience, the management of the town, left through the back door, running to the hotel to pick up his suitcase, a taxi to the airport, and on the way he swore he would never come back to this town after this embarrassing thing that happened. But many years later, 30 years later, some family members called him to come back to the town. So what he did is he arranged a flight late in the evening. He reserved a hotel room under a different name, Mr. Goldberg. He came very late in the evening, and there was a young guy behind the counter, because who works at midnight, just young people, right? So the young guy wanted to be very polite and ask Mr. Goldberg, have you ever, typing his name in the computer, Mr. Goldberg, have you been in our town before, or is it the first visit? And Goldberg thought, well, it's so late at night, so dark, I can be honest, right? He said, well, it happens so that I grew up in this town, but many years ago, something embarrassing happened, and I swore I would never come back, so I haven't visited this town for many, many years. And the young guy wanted to be very polite, so he said, well, I'm a young, they use the Yiddish word, I think, in the joke, stripling, I think, whatever that means. Yiddish is famous for being able to describe things in one word. There's a word for the pride of a grandfather seeing his children and grandchildren and, descendants. There's one word for that, the pride of the father. Anyway, this guy said, well, I'm a young guy, what do I know about life? But in my experience, limited, admittedly, sometimes we worry too much about things that people are looking at us, remembering, but really people don't even worry about it, don't notice. And Dropkin said, I doubt anybody would forget about that. And the young guy kept going, said, well, you said it was very long ago, right? Yes, it was very long ago. Was it before or after Dropkin's fart? I told you this joke because it has this element of giving a speech. That was the reason. Another thing is, of course, a general rule, as reputation is very difficult to gain, very easy to lose. The same with, Thank you very much.
Thank you.